Welcome, friends. Welcome back to our cast. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, bringing you yet another episode from the Architecture Insight Conference in Newport, Wales, in the UK, where I was just really happy to have the opportunity to have somebody like Martin Fowler and Ian Robinson from ThoughtWorks come on the show to talk to me about their thoughts on which the ways that we architect systems are changing. There's an evolution happening. New superior methods are evolving out of the old crud, the slime that architecture has crawled up out of. And well, I just wanted to know what these things are. And who better to ask than Martin Fowler and Ian Robinson? Let's welcome them to our cast.
Well, welcome back. I'm Ron Jacobs here at the Architecture Insight Conference here at the beautiful Celtic Manor Resort, where I'm joined today by Martin Fowler and Ian Robinson. Welcome, guys, to our cast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And so today we're going to talk about the evolution of architecture and where this is going. So how do you see architecture changing in the last few years? Where do you think it's going? Martin?
Well, when I think of the evolution of architecture, the focus that I tend to put onto it is that one of the sort of mistakes I think that we've tended to make in the industry is the view that a good design is something that you build and then develop, and then change is not something that one would expect. In fact, I think part of the underlying assumption has been that if you design things right first time, you don't have to change it, and that's when you know you've succeeded. And increasingly, people, I think, have come to the conclusion that, well, that's just a very unrealistic position to be in. So what we instead have to think about from the very beginning is, how do you constantly evolve and change the design or architecture of existing systems? And how do you make that, and a graceful way of doing that, really part of your basic way of working? And that's where I see this evolution of architecture being quite important. And of course, then there's a meta evolution of thinking about architecture. Is one of the evolutions is to realize that evolution is important, which is, I suppose, the meta question.
So architectures that can accommodate evolution.
And thinking about changes to how you put your stuff together and coming up with techniques that allow you to be able to make change more easily.
Ah, okay. So this is part of the push of why Agile has become a popular thing then, really, because I think in the past we sort of assumed that if we could perfectly understand the thing we needed to build up front, then we could perfectly gather requirements and perfectly build it, but in practice that wasn't practical.
Yeah. I mean, at a very basic level, a good example of this is refactoring, which is obviously something I've been long interested in. For a long time, people weren't really interested in how you would change an existing code base. Change of a code base was kind of seen as a necessary evil, preferably to be minimized, and always, one would expect, it would make things worse. And I very aggressively combated that. When I subtitled my book on refactoring, I talked about improving the design of existing code, that actually change can be a beneficial thing to the overall design. And that's had quite a significant impact. And now we're beginning to see refactoring tools appear. And I'm not going to take the credit for that, because that's the work of the people who did the tools. But I think we have changed the expectations of what people see. Increasingly, I see now that more able development teams are absolutely expecting refactoring to be a fundamental part of how they work.
Well, that's an interesting thought, because it's sort of a necessary aspect of maintaining the code in the long run.
Yes.
I can recall working on a product in Silicon Valley in the mid-90s where the original portions of this product were written under Windows 1.0, and they had never bothered to refactor anything. And so the code, by the time it got to 95, 96, was absolutely hideous. I mean, it was almost unmaintainable. because for that very reason, that they had never thought to maintain or to refactor it.
Yeah. And I think we're pretty good at accommodating change during software design and development, but we're less good at thinking about the overall lifetime of a system and change coming up once something's been deployed into production. How do we accommodate change? How do we help support operations and those people who have to maintain and support systems? And so a lot of our interest is in coming up with practices, designs, architectures that support change and evolution, not just during the initial design and development, but throughout the entire lifetime of the system.
And this is something that's particularly important, as I mean, this conference, like so many, is getting a lot of the service-oriented architecture buzz. Well, you know, surprise, surprise, services and their interfaces are going to have to change. And it's important to make that part of your way of thinking. And that's, I know, one of the things that Ian's particularly interested in is, well, how do you think about interfaces for that kind, that are changeable in that context?
Yeah. Well, and that's, but there's a tension there, isn't there? Because for years we've been telling people that interfaces should be immutable, that they should be fixed, and once people start using them, you can't change them. Yeah. How do you accommodate change with interfaces?
Right. I don't think that's necessarily true anymore when we're talking about a community of services, service providers and consumers. So I know that there's a lot of interest at the moment in how we evolve and version services, and I know that the Patterns and Practices Group has an interest in that. We've worked with clients to develop communities of service providers and consumers where we know that the provider needs to evolve independently of those consumers. And typically, we find that despite people adhering to those four tenets of SOA, nonetheless, they end up strongly coupling their consumers to their providers, and very often by reflecting the entire contract inside that consumer. So they use XSD validation or a kind of naive serialization, which means that whenever the provider wants to change and modify what is its interface and make ostensibly breaking changes, then all of those consumers have to jump at the same time. As we've been working with clients, we've helped to introduce ideas around doing just enough validation. So consumers really should be consuming only those bits of a provider that they really want and intend to process, rather than naively reflecting the entire service within each individual consumer. And if we can bring to the surface some of these real contracts that exist between service providers and consumers, how a service is actually being consumed here and now, if we have insight into that process, then we're better positioned to plan and manage the overall evolution of that system. So what we're talking about really is doing just enough validation, but also introducing a form of contract that really allows the consumers to express what it is they really want of a system, what business functionality they want to exploit, and what they expect those contracts that the service provider exposes, what they expect those contracts to consist in. And once we can have insight into those contracts, then I think we are better placed to evolve a provider independently from a consumer.
Okay. I'm not sure I understand. How could a service I as a consumer of a service, mm-hmm. consume it without taking too much, I don't know how to even express this,
okay.
too much dependency.
All right. So if we think, first of all, about the messages that we might want to exchange between a provider and a consumer.
Yeah.
And my provider might expose quite a complex message structure. It might be a pretty large message that I'm sending to a number of consumers. Now, each of those consumers might only be interested in a small amount of the information that's in that message. Typically, if they did XSD validation, then they're doing all or nothing validation of that entire document. But if the consumer had some way of telling the provider, well, I'm interested in these particular fields, that's the nature of my contract with you as a provider. Please guarantee that in the future, whatever you do as you evolve, you maintain that very particular contract and that contractual interest or expectation that I have of you. And then if the provider can be informed of each of those set of expectations that come from different consumers, then they really have a total set of expectations that they have to continue to fulfill. But everything else that falls outside of that set of expectations is up for grabs. They can change it willy-nilly.
And a good example of how that works is if you think of messages being transported around as XML documents. A good way to make things break with every change is to use some system that automatically generates a class off an XSD and something of that kind, and any time you change the document, boomf, you've got to rebuild the class in order to be able to consume it. So you've got real version issues. If you're only after three fields, what it's much better to do is to write something that says, okay, here's three little bits of XPath to tell me the three bits I want to get at, and I'll take that, that, and that. And then you've got a much more flexible approach. If you remove fields that you're not interested in or add extra fields, the thing still works, because you're just slicing into the document and grabbing what you need as opposed to trying to process the whole thing.
What's interesting about this is it sort of turns the model of contracts on its head, right? I mean, because our emphasis has always been on the contract from the server's or the service provider's point of view,
Yes. Saying,
here's my contract. And you're suggesting that it ought to be possible for the clients to say, well, I know you have that message, but I only care about this part.
Yeah. And we call that consumer-driven contracts.
Ah.
So to my mind, services are of no use to the business unless they're being consumed. So by trying to focus on those consumers and allowing them to express what functionality they want of a service, what business value they want to exploit, then we start really getting closer to the way in which a system is realizing some business value.
But now the interesting thing from the services point of view there would be that the parts of my contract that matter essentially become the union of the elements that the consumers care about.
Yeah.
And anything that no consumer cared about doesn't really matter.
Exactly. And so I may very well publish an interface that several methods, several different messages, documents, whatever. Those bits of that interface or that contract that nobody's using, well, if I got rid of it, who would notice? So that stuff about interfaces being immutable, I think there are ways of expressing our insights into the relationship between providers and consumers that change our attitude to interfaces.
Okay, I understand what you're saying, but I'm not sure I see the value in thinking about it this way. Maybe,
right.
I guess there is value in the sense that if I wanted to add something new to my contract that no consumer knew about, therefore they don't care about it, therefore it shouldn't really matter, it shouldn't break them, essence.
That's exactly the point.
Uh-huh.
I mean, a very simple change to an interface is you want to add a new field.
Yeah.
Maybe because this one consumer over here wants to have a field. Now, that shouldn't affect the 50 other consumers that I've currently got. They should just carry on working. There should be no change.
Uh-huh.
Now, if we define our contracts in terms of XSD, now we've got to either up a new version number or create a whole new service just in order to accommodate that one freaking little field that one guy wants. But if you'd think of your contracts in this consumer-oriented way, then nobody cares. You just add what you need for the one guy.
This kind of works against the whole flow of the way the tooling around all this stuff works, though, doesn't it? Because all the tooling is like, point me at your contract, I'll generate a proxy, and I'm very fixed on that contract. But if you change that contract, everything's going to blow up.
Yep. But I would say that a lot of the Microsoft tools, WSE, Indigo, even ASMX web services, allows us to inject different kinds of validators into the pipeline. So we can do just enough validation rather than consuming an entire service, all or nothing consumption of the service. So I think we do have a lot of flexibility at the level of the technologies we're using.
Well, it depends on how advanced you want to get, right? I mean, it's the very simplest ways to do these things are always going to be very tightly bound to the contract, or at least they are today.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
And, that's fine in many, many circumstances. But where we know we have a community of services where we want some of them to evolve, or we know that some of them are going to evolve at different rates, then I think at that point it's worthwhile considering some of these other issues and thinking about consumer-driven contracts.
And how does the consumer... how does this knowledge of what the consumer cares about flow back to the service provider?
Okay. So we have expressed this in terms of a pattern, and we've tried to remain relatively implementation agnostic. So you could do it entirely out of band. You know, if you've got teams sitting next to one another, they could actually turn to one, you know, one team member turn to another and say, you know, these are the things that we're really interested in, that we're really using. But you can obviously work your way up the stack and start actually passing messages out of band. And there's provision for that in many ways. Metadata exchange and stuff like that give us a model for being able to exchange lots of additional information about the way in which services are being consumed.
Interesting.
Wow. Well, another good way is to think of it in terms of example approaches, and particularly uses of tests. I mean, if I require these three fields to be present on the message, well, I can write test cases that express that, and then send those test cases back to the provider and basically say, as long as those test cases run, I'm going to be okay. Yeah. And so then the provider effectively has to look at the union of the test cases of the consumers. So those kinds of techniques can also be used to try and do this kind of thing.
Okay, but, so this is one way in which we're supporting the requirement for evolution of the services by maybe not being so tightly bound to the message contracts from the consumer side. Are there some other ways you guys are thinking about architecture evolving to support this sort of rapid change?
Well, another area that in particular a colleague of ours has been working in is that of evolving databases, because databases have traditionally been considered to be one of the things that you just got to get right at the beginning. And Pramod Sadlaga is the name of my colleague, who's been doing this kind of stuff since about 1999, when we worked together on a project in the States. And just last week, he and Scott Ambler released a book in my series, I'm proud to say, on refactoring databases, which is all about how do you make these kinds of changes in databases. And a lot of this kind of stuff is fairly similar. You want to be able to do things like add a column to a table, and that's obviously, because of the nature of SQL itself, is usually a non-destructive change, because if you add a column, it doesn't affect any of your SQL calls, because you either name what you have or you take it all with a star. That has that same property that you're not breaking. That was built into SQL. But obviously one of the complications with databases is you also have to migrate the data. So a refactoring of a database also has to include data migration as part of that. And these techniques have not been terribly well known, but we've been steadily using them on a bunch of projects over the last 4 or 5 years. And that, to me, is another very significant shift in enterprise systems is for increasing classes of applications, we can deal with refactoring the database. Now, one of the big issues lies in when the database itself is being used as an integration mechanism. And this is where, again, I think that the service-oriented architecture thing actually works kind of nicely, because at least one of the common assumptions between service-oriented architecture is you should hide the database stuff behind a different kind, more message-oriented whatever API. And then you don't use a shared database as your integration mechanism. Use some kind of messaging technique. So that fits in well with that.
Well, I think one of the really enlightening things, and Ian, you mentioned that you were involved in the integration patterns work. And when I was in patterns and practices, we used that. It was a wonderful work, highly recommended. But one of the enlightening things to me about that I learned from that project was as people have moved more towards service-oriented integration as the key way, the prime way to integrate systems, often they've found that sometimes the sheer volume of data that must be integrated sort of overwhelms the technology stacks that support service-oriented integration right now. So that leads to different styles of integration, such as shared database.
Yes, yeah. So you end up with several different styles within any one system. I think that's fine. You know, we deal all the time with heterogeneous systems, and that's no problem. But if we need to have a certain awareness of what we're doing and insights into it, rather than having the technology lead us. It's a matter of evolving the practices and the insights so that we have more confidence as we're moving into production and supporting and operating a system.
Well, you find that, you know, someone will come up and say, oh, I'm trying to integrate these two systems, and it worked pretty well in a test environment, but once we started moving, you know, millions of rows a day, it did it begin to fall over pretty quickly. And so, you know, this is when you realize that the expense of the serialization to XML and back is very, very significant when it comes to the sheer volume of data.
And that's probably going to become an increasing problem. I think we're going to see more and more instrumentation injected into those services as we're exchanging documents and messages. And so there's inevitably going to be an overhead, not just about serializing data, but inspecting it as we receive it or as we send it. We need to start thinking about those issues as well.
Okay. So we've talked about sort of refactoring services and refactoring databases. What else is evolving in architecture?
Well, those are the two, I guess, that are very much in the front of my mind. But I think more of it is we just have to look at that as a sort of a constant statement that we have to look at. Whenever we're coming up with a design about anything, we have to say, okay, well, what's version 2 and version 3 going to look like, and how are we going to get there in the gracefulest way we can do that? And that's one of the things I like about iterative development, because it kind of forces you to evolve all the time, even in your development stage. One of the nice things about the evolutionary database stuff was Pramod would do this every single iteration. He'd evolve the database. He'd migrate all the test data. He'd do all of this months before the thing went live. And what happened, of course, is that when the system went live and he had to evolve a live database, he'd already figured out how to do it. It was already a done thing. So in many ways, iterative development forces you into this constant evolution notion. And yeah, it causes a lot of pain because you have to solve all the problems about evolution early on in a project, but early pain is part of the benefits of agile development, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, the point is we're going to have pain anyway. We might as well get it over with early on. I mean, you know, when you talk to people about evolving a database, especially a production database, the pain is in that data migration, just simply adding a column or whatever. The database might churn for a couple of days while it migrates over the data. So you do have to have a very specific plan about how you're going to accomplish that.
Embrace pain.
Yeah, well, just get the pain early while you're still able to deal with it. You know, the worst thing to do is to have it, you know, when you're in a rush and you've got a hell of a lot of other things to do. And also, you know, do little bits of pain at a time. So it gradually builds up and you learn techniques and you can apply those techniques steadily. And then you'll figure out how to cope. It's just the same as with integration. Integration used to be a big pain for lots and lots, still is, of course, for lots and lots of projects. I mean, for us at ThoughtWorks, integration has been a non-event for many years because we've learned to integrate all the time, multiple times a day. We had a hand, obviously, in developing Cruise Control and CruiseControl.net, and lots of projects all over the world now use these tools and do continuous integration. And the big pain of integration has, you know, disappeared for so many folks now as a result of that. And I think that's another great example of, if it's painful, do it more often.
What I can recall early in my development career, I worked on a very distributed team, and so we would off be, you know, these guys over here doing their little bit and these guys doing their little bit, and we'd all have our thing working. And then, every couple of weeks, we'd go through this very, very painful process of everybody trying to put all the changes together, and suddenly nothing would work for 2, 3, 5 days. You know, nothing's working, and then we'd get going again, and that was extraordinarily unproductive.
Yeah. Everything stops, and even at the end of those 5 days, you're not entirely sure where you stand. Things are working, but does it support the level of functionality you expected it to before you try to integrate those two systems, or have you introduced other problems that are still to pop out a little further down the line?
Yeah, and regressions were always occurring because one side would get the fix in, but the other side wouldn't. And in the integration, the good set of changes would get thrown away, and they would always come back. And lots of pain would definitely evolve around that.
I mean, Martin's already mentioned cruise control and continuous integration, but another colleague here, Graham Tackley, has been doing a lot of work around deploying into virtual server environments. So every day, you know, in addition to continuous integration, we'll also be deploying into environments that try to reproduce the production environments, and we can tear them down and redeploy into them over and over again. So again, we're trying to avoid being surprised by changes between development and test environments and then production environments.
Well, and I think that's absolutely one of the best things that's happened in a long time is this ability to virtualize the production environment, especially when you're involving other parties in your development process, because they can actually reproduce the production environment in their location, which is something that was virtually impossible before. And you would never know if everything was going to work until you got it into the real environment.
Yes.
Yeah. So, now, Martin, let me ask you a little bit about patterns, because it's one of the things you're well known for. I'm always grasping about how are patterns really, really helping people, architects in the real world? I mean, other than that, you know, we know a lot of people that have bought the books and they have them sitting on their shelf. But when did they become, how do you make them actually helpful in your daily work?
Well, of course, I'm not the right person to ask that question to, since I'm the person who writes about them. Ian maybe is the better person to actually ask to use the stuff.
Well, I think, firstly, good patterns are really after the fact. They are an expression of experience. So I'm always wary when somebody comes up with a new pattern that probably hasn't been tried and tested. So good patterns are a reflection of what we've been doing for a long time. Software development community. So it's distilled experience, distilled knowledge. And we end up with a way of describing systems that don't necessarily have to go all the way down to the technical level, to the implementation details. But it's something that helps us bridge the gap between the business and the functionality that we're trying to provide to that business. I think it introduces a middle ground into the picture. And a way of talking about systems that can involve a broader range of stakeholders. So there's a language and a vocabulary that day-to-day helps development teams talk to all the other stakeholders in the project. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of very specific patterns that I wouldn't bother raising, but a lot of the integration patterns in particular help us describe what it is that we're anticipating doing as we connect systems. And they do make sense of what we're doing to the business.
Okay, so, you know, a pattern is putting a name on something that we've already been doing anyway, but to many people who haven't been doing that thing, I mean, the hope, I think, is that they could read about it or learn about it, and then suddenly they're benefiting from the collective experience of those who did it.
Well, that's certainly the intention, is to try and say, well, here's what we currently understand about how this pattern works and when you should use it. And that's something that people can use as a starting point, so they don't begin from a blank sheet of paper. They can actually begin from some degree of guidance as to how to do things. It definitely will never cover 100% of the circumstances, because there's so much stuff that's in the localized thing. So one of my taglines is, patterns are all half-baked. You have to finish them off yourself. But the point is, you are starting at least halfway along. You've got some idea of what you've got to worry about, some sense of some of the issues to deal with and how you can deal with them. And it will let you get there a little bit quicker. And I'm not someone who looks for huge silver bullet victories. Tiny little victories please me. So that's why I tend to be comfortable with patterns, because it's lots of little victories.
Yeah, well, and you know, the thing we always struggled with when I was in the patterns and practices team is thinking about, well, okay, so we created a book like Integration Patterns, but how do we help drive that experience into the day-to-day work of the people who have to get these things done? Mm. And probably the easiest way is to take a patterns and the patterns and bake them into a framework that people can just apply. But that quickly becomes difficult because the frameworks begin to grow exponentially and become very complex beasts on their own. And so we were after the silver bullet victories, like you said, and sometimes they're very difficult to achieve. Whereas, you know, just taking a small pattern, understanding it, and applying it is really the goal.
Yeah. Perhaps patterns are simply an invitation to experience the pain earlier. You know, if you get excited.
Well, everybody's after pain-free development, but we haven't gotten there yet, are we?
Oh, we never will. Software development is tough. I mean, and it's, I don't think anything's going to make it easier. I mean, certain things will become easier, like memory management, for instance, that memory-managed systems make that much easier. But then we get whole new problems to deal with as well because we're always wanting to do more with the software. So I think as a fundamental activity, software development is always going to be hard and always going to benefit most from having talented people working on it. What we can do is try and accelerate the process as much as we can, make the whole thing as rapid and have new and different kinds of pain instead of the old ones. You know, I'm very happy to no longer have to manage my own memory, thank you very much. That's great. But it doesn't mean there's a lack of things to do.
Yeah. Well, Martin and Ian, thank you so much for joining me today on ArtCast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Martin Fowler and Ian Robinson, ladies and gentlemen. Hey. Wow. Thinking about the evolution of architecture. You know, these guys are some really smart thinkers, and I love the work they've done with patterns. And, you know, I've encountered ThoughtWorks through my time with Patterns and Practices, and we collaborated with them around many projects, and they were just terrific. You can tell they really know their stuff and are really thinking out on the edge of where things are going. And this is just fantastic stuff, so... You know, I'd encourage you to go take a look at their site on ThoughtWorks.com. They have some interesting papers and some patterns. Ian gave me a paper of some of the patterns that he's done. And that's great. That's why we're here on ArtCast.